event open to the public on the 12th of November and will run for 5 nights. Preparations for the event, however, started a month ago. The organizers say millions of bulbs and 17 miles of cables are used for the 18 art installations.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Given the fact that Hamas espouses Islamic values and that its defense of Masjid al-Aqsa is profoundly admired, it is widely believed that the overwhelming majority of Muslims across the world support it. Britain's 4 million plus Muslim population would be no exception to this. It goes without saying that solidarity with Palestine's freedom struggle is intertwined with the support for Hamas. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Iqbal Jassat, journalist. This article is published under the heading, "The British Empire Strikes Against Palestinian Resistance Group, Hamas." Stay tuned for more. The British government's discredited Home Secretary Priti Patel has once again emerged as the Zionist regime's leading in-house lobbyist. Though her credibility was severely dented when, as UK aid minister, she had to resign in 2017 following her scandalous unauthorized meetings with senior Zionist regime officials, Patel has made a comeback to yet again plunged the British establishment into a deeper foreign policy mess. She has now announced dramatic plans to proscribe Palestinian Liberation Movement, Hamas, as a terrorist entity. Previously, only the military wing of Hamas, the Dinghassam Brigades, was proscribed under the UK Terrorism Act 2000. In a statement released by her, Patel sounded no different to right-wing hawks in control of the apartheid regime, saying Hamas has significant terrorist capability, including access to extensive and sophisticated weaponry as well as training facilities. That is why today I have acted to proscribe Hamas in its entirety. Though her prescription order was introduced a few days ago, and debating and voting were expected to follow shortly, the process will require approval by Parliament. If approved, showing support for Hamas, including organizing events in support of them and flying the movement's flag, could see punishments of up to 14 years in prison. Not surprisingly, the Zionist regime has gleefully welcomed Patel's announcement, War Minister Benny Gantz said it sends a strong message of zero tolerance toward terrorist activities aimed at harming Israel and Jewish communities. Absent from most media reports is the bizarre fact that Patel confirmed her moves in a speech on security and counterterrorism in Washington. British diplomatic correspondent James Landale suggested that the decision should also be seen through a domestic UK prism. Israel has been pushing for this for some time, and the fact it is now happening reflects the deep contacts that Israel has within the Conservative Party. No newcomer to controversy, Patel is described by various British sources, including Wikipedia, as Eurosceptic. She was a leading figure in the Vote Leave campaign for Brexit during the 2016 referendum on UK membership of the European Union. Reports indicate that following Cameron's resignation, Patel supported Theresa May's bid to become Conservative leader. May subsequently appointed Patel Secretary of State for International Development. However, Patel's breach of the ministerial code in 2017, when she was involved in a shameful political scandal involving clandestine meetings with Netanyahu and fellow regime leaders in the occupied territories, ended her tenure. Though the unauthorized conduct of holding 12 separate meetings during a family holiday to the occupied territories without notifying the foreign officer Downing Street had disgraced her, Boris Johnson ignored Patel's violations by resuscitating her political career. That the controversy surrounding her turbulent political career would expectedly have cushioned responsible leaders, Johnson chose to cave into the pro-Israel lobby by deploying her in one of the most powerful cabinet positions. In making this outlandish move, Patel has selectively chosen to remain silent on the fact that Hamas, having engaged in Palestine's political process and won the legislative elections in 2006, was rebuffed by the British regime. In doing so, the UK defied and denied the political choice made by Palestinians. As expected, Hamas has expressed its shock and dismay at the move. It called on the government to apologize for the Balfour Declaration, which illegally set the stage for the creation of a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine in 1917 during the month of November. The statement added, "The Palestinian people, backed by the Arab and Muslim nations and the free people of the world, will continue their fight for freedom and return at any cost and will not be discouraged by those who failed to support them. We are confident that the Palestinians will fulfill their aspirations for freedom and independence sooner or later." Given the fact that Hamas espouses Islamic values and that its defense of Masjid al-Aqsa is profoundly admired, it is widely believed that the overwhelming majority of Muslims across the world support it. Britain's 4 million plus Muslim population would be no exception to this. It goes without saying that solidarity with Palestine's freedom struggle is intertwined with support for Hamas. But by Patel's decree, Muslims and millions of British citizens of various faith groups found to be pro-Hamas will face criminal charges and the prospects of long-term jail.
Firing mortars at us here. Seven difficult years have passed since the war broke out in Syria. 7 years is by no means a short period of time, and when you review the many different incidents that took place, it feels like it has actually lasted for decades. According to international reports, by the end of 2018, the Syrian war has claimed the lives of more than 500,000 people and left 12 million others displaced. Now the conflict has entered the eighth year, and Syria is nothing like the beautiful country it once was. Perhaps this is what makes it so interesting to visit and witness its realities. Syria in 2018. The story of Syria always starts from Aleppo, which is not the capital, but the most important city in the country. This is why capturing Aleppo meant victory for both sides of the conflict. But finally, in 2016, the war in Aleppo ended, and the very last armed groups left the city. Now the main issue is returning to normal life in this old city, where only 1 million out of its previous 5 million population is left. The war for the liberation of Aleppo lasted 4 long years, but it was well worth the fight. Aleppo, the most important Syrian city, was occupied by the terrorists, and it became the symbol of resistance and victory. Now, there are many stories from Aleppo's resistance spread throughout Syria. One of the most famous stories is about the citadel of Aleppo, where the defenders of the city fought tooth and claw. The citadel of Aleppo was a symbol of the city, like a flag raised above the land. Unlike the war, which is over in most parts of Syria, the process of returning displaced people to their cities and homes has only just begun. The cities are razed to the ground, and in some places, there isn't a single building left unharmed. But the people insist on returning to their homes and hometowns. And these days, Aleppo is the biggest symbol of the people's enthusiasm to return home. These days, Syria is filled with bizarre events and situations. Here in Aleppo, people are impatiently waiting to return to their homes. But not too far away, there are people who are forced to flee from their houses. But this time, the Takfiri terrorists are not the occupiers that has decided to occupy some parts of the country under the pretext of removing the Kurdish threat. The people of this region, who were under the control of the terrorists not long ago, are now displaced by the Turkish army and its affiliated armed forces. The refugees are fleeing Tunub and El Zahra, the two Shia towns that were besieged for 2 years. And this is another extraordinary event that is taking place in Nubl and El Zahra these days. The Shia people of Nubl and El Zahra, who have just recently been liberated, are now the host of their Sunni countrymen. And this is happening in a place where they strive to portray the war as sectarian conflicts. Turkey has been on one side of the conflict in Syria all throughout the 7 years of war, just like Saudi Arabia and the United States. But when the outcome was not what they had expected, Turkey entered the battlefields to have a say in Syria's future. Turkey, under the pretext of the Kurdish threat to its borders, and the United States, under the pretext of maintaining its military bases in Jordan, entered Syria. The arrival of these new occupiers is part of the events shaping Syria these days. Homs is considered the heart of Syria. You cannot speak about the news in Syria without talking about Homs and the events which are taking place in this large province. The undeniable fact is that in the Syrian war, a portion of the people joined the armed groups and entered a war with the central government. Although the armed forces are no longer in town, their families are still living in Homs among the ordinary citizens. For sure, it is merely wishful thinking to believe that they all regret their past. Many of them have lost their loved ones in this war and are filled with resentment and a desire for revenge. This fact cannot be denied in today's Syria. So when the armed groups are referred to as the armed forces instead of the opposition, their family members refuse to proceed with the interview as a sign of protest. In Syria, Christians are not a small minority. You can see them in many different parts of the country, and some towns and villages can even be found that are completely populated by Christians. One such town is the Christian town of Marde. The war in Syria was different for two groups of people compared to the rest of the country, Shias and Christians. The situation would grow worse if the terrorists could identify a place with an unmixed population of Shias or Christians. In such cases, the outcome was predictable. If the terrorists entered such towns or villages, no one would manage to escape alive. In these 7 years of war, there were so many execution squads that it was not hard to guess the outcome. This was the reason that compelled the Shias and Christians to defend their country, towns, and villages with all their might. Today, Syria is full of Christian families who have lost their loved ones for the freedom of their country, and they proudly speak about their resistance and martyrs. The Syrian war was not a religious one, but attempts were made from the very beginning to find an excuse to create tensions between the world's Muslims and the central government of Syria. However, reality was something different. For example, many of the people of Hama, an almost unmixed population of Sunnis, refused to accompany the armed groups and did not fight against the government. Now that the war is over and the dust has settled, the truth about the lies that were broadcast to the world about Syria can be revealed. For example, the story of the use of chemical weapons against the people of Douma and the footage of the boy who was claimed to be one of the victims of the attack.
The story dominates.
It was claimed that the Syrian army had used chemical weapons in Douma, after which the United States, the United Kingdom, and France attacked the country to punish the Syrian army. But in fact, they targeted some areas that they had planned before and were just waiting for an excuse to launch their attacks. These days in Syria, many of the events that took place during the war are being re-examined in retrospect, especially by the youth in Syria, people such as Muhammad Ali. After 7 years, the events of the war can be put together like different pieces of a puzzle. For example, why did the events in Douma escalate, and why was it used against the central government of Syria? When the Syrian government decided to put an end to the mortar attacks fired from Ghouta into Damascus, suddenly the story of Douma was made into media frenzy. Ghouta was the prestige of the armed forces in Syria. It was the only place in the Arab country which was close to Damascus and was still in the hands of the terrorists. For these 7 years, and especially the Saudi-affiliated groups, were threatening Damascus from there. These days in Syria, the exchange of arms and the transfer of armed forces is a reality. For the government and the resistance forces, even one less casualty is considered a victory, because these killings nurture the feelings of resentment and revenge across the generations in Syria. For this reason, in the Battle of Ghouta, when it became clear that the struggle of the armed forces would lead nowhere and they would all die if they kept fighting, the armed groups were allowed to leave the battlefield. With the liberation of Eastern Ghouta, the people of Damascus can live in peace after 7 long years. Before this, the armed forces would attack Damascus with mortars anytime they wished, killing the loved ones of families. A case in point is the tragedy that happened recently to martyr Mohammad Reza Shami. Syria in 2018 is a land of both sadness and joy. Joy because of the recapture and liberation of many regions across the country, and sadness due to the loss of so many loved ones and sheer amount of destruction and devastation. The Syrian people fought tooth and claw for their country, and Iran and the resistance fighters were with them. Now finally, after 7 years, the story of Syria and its war is coming to an end. The armed groups expected that it would end, but the story of Syria's war has a different ending. It ends with the last terrorists exiting the region. Damascus stands proudly, like many other cities, even those that were under occupation someday. But the scarred soul and bruised body of the nation needs time and care to heal.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Limelight. Drone whistleblower Daniel Hale is in a communications management unit, CMU, at a medium security federal prison in Marion, Illinois. He is closely monitored by the FBI and Bureau of Prisons officials, so they can prevent him from further commenting on the bloodshed caused by U.S. drone strikes. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Kevin Gostzola, journalist. This article is published under the heading Pentagon Suppressed Whistleblowers Who Exposed Massacres in Syria. Stay tuned for more. Whistleblowers in the United States military exposed a strike in Syria that resulted in the massacre of around 70 women and children, according to an investigation by the New York Times. The command responsible for the strike, considered a war crime, may have taken place, but a report by the Office of Inspector General for the Defense Department removed this opinion. Officials in the Pentagon impeded an investigation and ensured no one would ever be held accountable for the civilian death. They also turned on one of the whistleblowers, forcing them out of their position in IG's office. What happened proves once again that going through proper channels can be a fruitless and risky career-ending effort. Lisa Ling, a former tech sergeant who worked on drone surveillance systems and is a known whistleblower, reacted, "Again, the public is notified of a war crime by a brave whistleblower who was eventually forced out of their job. This is a pattern that exemplifies the need for robust whistleblower protections, especially for the intelligence community so often carved out of them. We need more light shined in these secret spaces so this doesn't happen again and again and again without the public knowing what is done in our name." As the Times reported on March 18, 2019, in the last days of the battle against Daesh in Syria, when members of the once fierce caliphate were cornered in a dirt field next to a town called Maroz, a U.S. military drone circled high overhead, hunting for military targets. But it saw only a large crowd of women and children huddled against a riverbank. U.S. military forces launched a double-tap strike. An American F-15E attack jet dropped a 500-pound bomb. As survivors scrambled for cover, another jet dropped a 2,000-pound bomb that killed most of the survivors. A high-definition drone recorded the scene prior to the bombing. Two or three men were near a compound, though they had rifles. Neither engaged coalition forces. Women and children were observed in the area. At nearly every step, the military made moves that concealed the catastrophic strike. The death toll was downplayed, reports were delayed, sanitized, and classified, and the Times added coalition forces bulldozed the blast site. The strike was the work of a classified U.S. Special Operations unit known as Task Force 9. They were responsible for the third worst casualty event in Syria. According to the Times, an unnamed Air Force intelligence officer in the Combined Air Operations Center at Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar contacted Lieutenant Colonel Dean Corsack, who was an Air Force lawyer. They were ordered to preserve video and another evidence from the F-15E squadron and drone crew. Corsack concluded a possible war crime was committed that required an independent investigation. He noted that Task Force 9 was clearly seeking to cover up incidents like this strike by logging false entires after the fact. For example, the man had a gun. We'll be right back. the Air Force's Office of Special Investigations was notified. However, as the Times recalled, a major refused to investigate. Civilian casualties were only investigated if there was a potential for media attention, concern with outcry from local community and government, and or concerned sensitive images may get out. In other words, if the Pentagon needed to get ahead of a potential scandal, they would investigate and craft a narrative that could tamp down outrage. But they did not believe the bowels strike would ever make headlines. Korsak tried once more to convince his superiors to investigate in May 2019. They still refused. So Korsak filed a hotline complaint with the IG's office in August 2019. Gene Tate, a former Navy officer who had worked for years as a civilian analyst with the Defense Intelligence Agency and the National Counterterrorism Center before moving to the Inspector General's office, told the Times, "When Korsak came to us, he wanted to make it very clear he had tried everything else first. He felt the IG hotline was the only option remaining. Roadblocks prevented Tate from having any success. He could not find the footage from the task force drone that called in the strike. U.S. Central Command CENTCOM removed the war crime finding from a report on the massacre. In January 2020, according to the Times investigation, the Deputy Inspector General refused to sign off on a memo that would have alerted authorities to the war crime. Tate did not hesitate to criticize leadership in IG's office, and by October 2020, he was forced out of the office. In May 2021, Tate contacted the Senate Armed Services Committee and sent a 10-page letter that detailed the bowels strike. However, as of November 13th, he was still waiting for any member of the committee to call him back. To further illustrate how stunning it is that senators on the committee ignored what Tate shared, CIA officers in Syria were so alarmed by the conduct of Task Force 9 that they complained to IG's Office for Defense Department. According to one former task force officer quoted by the Times, CIA officers alleged that in 10 incidents, the secretive task force hit targets knowing civilians would be killed. The New York Times shared their reporting with CENTCOM prior to publication and asked for official comment. CENTCOM acknowledged 80 people were killed but insisted the strike was justified. The bombs killed 16 fighters and 4 civilians. As for the other 60 people killed, the statement said it was not clear that they were civilians, in part because women and children in Daesh sometimes took up arms, according to CENTCOM. This is actually part of the legacy of President Barack Obama's administration. He developed a method of counting civilian casualties that would not box him in. In 2012, the Times reported all military-age males in a strike zone found dead were presumed to be combatants unless there was explicit intelligence posthumously proving them innocent. If commanding officers refuse to support an investigation into a massacre, then they never have to worry about an investigation moving death in the combatant column to the civilian column, which would make them look bad. On November 3rd, the Air Force released the findings of the investigation into the U.S. drone strike in Kabul on August 29th that killed Zimari Ahmadi, an aid worker and father, his 3 sons, 2 of his nephews, and 3 girls who were toddlers. They exonerated themselves. The investigation found no violation of law, including the law of war. Air Force Inspector General Sami Sai declared, "We did find execution errors combined with confirmation bias and communication breakdowns that regrettably led to civilian casualties." But Said is undoubtedly implicated in the cover-up of countless war crimes committed by Task Force 9 and various other special operations units which engage in similar bombing attacks. Meanwhile, drone whistleblower Daniel Hale is in a communications management unit, CMU, at a medium security federal prison in Marion, Illinois. He's closely monitored by the FBI and Bureau of Prisons officials so they can prevent him from further commenting on the bloodshed caused by the United States drone strikes. Commenting on how the cycle of violence with militant groups continues, Link stated, "They don't hate our way of life. They rightfully hate our way of killing. 7 innocent women and children were needlessly killed in Syria, 10 killed in Afghanistan, and plenty more we will never know about. These are human beings, and we took their lives while using sanitized words with fancy legal footwork to get away with breaking international law. It is wrong. It is terror. And I believe Americans are complicit as long as we remain silent about what is being done in our name." Link concluded, "We cannot fight a war on terror with more terror."
During the Vietnam War, the U.S. military engaged in an aggressive program of chemical warfare codenamed Operation Ranch Hand. And from 1961 to 1971, the U.S. military sprayed a range of herbicides across more than 4.5 million acres of Vietnam to destroy the forest cover and food crops used by North Vietnamese. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. Agent Orange, which contains the deadly chemical dioxin, was the most commonly used herbicide. It was later proven to cause serious health issues, including cancer, birth defects, rashes, and severe psychological and neurological problems. But the Vietnamese were not the only ones affected. U.S. soldiers unknowingly brought the legacy of Agent Orange back home. Join us for this week's Aperture as we meet three children of U.S. veterans who fall victim to Agent Orange and follow them as they travel to Vietnam to face their demons. Here's the first part.
All I ever heard was war stories about how horrible it was and how violent everything was and that there was just death and destruction, and that's the picture that was painted in my head of what Vietnam was. And it scared me half to death when I was getting ready to come over here, to the point where I was actually shaking on the plane on my way here because I did not know what to expect.
Traveling here, someone said, you know, Heather travels back to the land of her father's demons. Vietnam is still a very scary, dangerous place to them.
I was actually very nervous and very scared. Several of my father's friends kind of scared me about some of the things that I may see and hear and experience. Their vision of Vietnam was a war-torn, angry place.
Do you guys have any bottled water before we get going, just in case?
My name is Josh Kelly. I was born on August 18th, 1975.
My name is Heather Bowser. My maiden name is Morris.
My name is Rachel Harding. I was born in northern Indiana near Chicago.
My dad was Daniel Kelly. He was in the U.S. Marine Corps. and he fought in Vietnam.
My parents had married 9 days before he had left for Vietnam. They said that, you know, if they had 9 days being together, that's what they wanted to do.
My father got his draft papers when he turned 18 and chose to marry my mother before he left. They got married, and 2 weeks later, he was deployed to Vietnam.
I've been trying to find out what exactly happened when he was there, because when I was younger, I tried to block the stories out because some of them were so scary and so violent and all that, that I just tried to not even listen to them because I didn't want to hear it, because they scared the fuck out of me because I was just a kid.
When they came home, they wanted to put the war behind them. The Vietnam War was a very difficult political time, civil rights time, and so wanting to put it behind them, start their family, and move on.
As soon as he came home, they chose to wait to have children. They waited about 7 years before they decided to try, and I was the firstborn.
So my mother had two miscarriages. She lost two children. And no one in our family had had any kind of problems in that respect. So it was very unexpected. And then in 1972, my mother was pregnant again and felt that she had gone into labor early. She was not due for a while. They went to the hospital. She had already lost two children, so she was very scared. She thought she might be miscarrying again at a very late time in the pregnancy. They rushed her into the hospital, and she said, I'm in labor. And she was very thin, and they kind of said, no, you're okay. It's okay. You're going to be all right. You're not in labor. You barely was pregnant. She was 7 months along at that point. My mother woke up to my father sitting at her bedside telling her, and it's hard to talk about, but he said, Sharon, she's damaged. And that's what she woke up to. So I can only imagine how scary that was.
The doctors, as soon as I was born, they took me from my mom, and they put me in a little incubator, and then they rushed me off out of the room. They didn't explain anything to my mom. They just said that there was problems.
Various doctors approached my mother at different times and asked what she had done to her child. What had she done to cause such terrible problems?
They brought her over to show me to her for about 5 minutes, and then they put me on an airplane and they flew me to another state, and they kept me in the incubator, and they put me in intensive care, and they had all kinds of doctors looking at me and checking to see if I was going to live or die, or what the deal was, because missing my arms and my leg, they weren't sure what all was wrong with me. They started to take me to the doctors and stuff out there, and because they were big hospitals and there was lots of doctors from around the world and everything, they wanted to try a whole bunch of different surgeries and stuff that were like experimental surgeries that nobody had ever tried before, like One of them was that they wanted to grow my arms back, and the way that they were going to do it is they were going to cut the skin open, break the bone, and then they were going to drill holes through it and put screws in it and put plates to separate the bone, and the bone would grow in between the gaps. And they said that it could take up to 5 to 10 years for my arms to finish growing back, and that it would be an extremely painful.
I want to go back to real quick to one memory I had in kindergarten. We were learning about our hands. This is your left hand, this is your right hand. And it's always a memory that I kind of laugh about. I loved school. I couldn't wait to go to school. I was so excited. I wanted to read and do that stuff. So we're sitting in this circle, and the little children are sitting there, and I can just remember this to this day. And there was like a board on the floor, and it had a picture, an outline of a hand and another hand. And each child was to go around and take their turn and say, this is my left hand, this is my right hand, this is my left hand, this is my right hand. And so I remember just being anxious and excited to do my turn. And I went to put my hand in, and I just, at that moment, I was like, oh, okay. Because they had the outline, and my fingers didn't match the outline. And I was like, okay, this is my left hand, this is my right hand, but they don't look like that left hand and that right hand. And that was kind of like, okay, I'm different. That's different.
Pretty much all my life, as far back as I can remember, I knew I was different because I was always going to the doctors, and I would always see the other kids playing and stuff, and I couldn't really go play with them because I either had doctor's appointments or they didn't want anything to do with me. Or
I have lost 19 children. I never carried more longer than 8.5 weeks, and I would lose my children. I have hypothyroidism, the infertility issue, and psoriatic arthritis. Those are the three biggest ones that I have that affect my life personally. And my family could not understand, my father included, could not understand, where did this come from? Nobody else in the family's ever had this. How come you're suffering from this and nobody else ever has?
I've seen lots of different kids that had disabilities and stuff from being like in the hospitals and stuff all the time, and some of them are so similar that it would have to be from the same thing. The similarities in our disabilities is so much alike. There's no way to deny that it was the same thing that caused both of them.
These are the structural formulas for 2,4-dichlorophenoxyacetic acid, commonly known as 2,4-D and 2,4,5-T. From these chemicals are made a large number of closely related compounds, which are sold commercially for weed and brush control. The Secretary of Defense initiated a project to determine whether visibility in troublesome jungle vegetation in the Republic of Vietnam could be improved by aerially applied chemical sprays. In that country, jungle growth, swamp foliage, and roadside vegetation retains its leaves the year around. Consequently, it affords ideal concealment to guerrilla terrorists who sporadically attack the free people of Vietnam. As a result of these tests, defoliation spraying was placed on an operational basis. Those chemicals already proven most effective as defoliants will continue to be used until faster acting.
So my father says that he said that there was spraying of his base pretty regularly. I found out since that his base was practically sprayed every day, and that is also due to its proximity to Benoit. Benoit was the epicenter of where Ranch Hand worked out of. So if they had anything left on their missions, they came around that area and used it. The perimeter was hand sprayed, aerial spraying with the C-123 planes.
My dad was in the U.S. Marine Corps. He was stationed in the Chu Lai Air Base, and while he was there, he was exposed to lots of Agent Orange. They sprayed it on everything. It was in the food, it was in the water, it was on their clothes, it was on the plants, it was on the guns, the ammo, everything had Agent Orange on it. So he was heavily exposed to Agent Orange.
North Vietnam charged today that defoliants have produced many instances of miscarriages, congenital defects, and monstrosities among children.
As we anticipated, the Vietnamese doctors that we've met with very much share our concerns about the effects of Agent Orange.
Although that war was long ago, there is lingering anger about the United States' use of a controversial defoliant spread by American aircraft on the jungles there.
Milton Ross, a special forces advisor near Pleiku, has a son born without the tips of his fingers.
Frank Moore is nearly dead from cancer. He thinks the cancer was caused by chemical defoliants he was exposed to as a soldier in Vietnam.
My dad explained to me about how dangerous the stuff was because it would kill off big old trees and everything in just a couple of days. He would tell me the stories about how he would have to mix it and he would have to load it into the tanks and he would put the tanks on the planes and the helicopters and everything while he was in the war.
It's still causing trouble and all of the people that have lost their lives to Agent Orange, and this is kind of where it began. So it's very sad.
We found out that the rate of miscarriages, fetal death in utero, and birth defects are 4 times higher than in the exposed, among the exposed, than the non-exposed. We have carried out some more studies. I'm now very sure, certain, that toxic chemicals cause many things to my people, to the exposed people. Cannot deny the relationship between dioxin with the abnormal outcome of pregnancy among the exposed people.
After the war time, I mean, after 75, his father is dead, came back here, and they have the first child. But due to the Asian noise, she or he died after 10 days.
The biggest biggest child of the family is a normal child because he was born before the time that the death came to the army.
But do you know in America who carries the pain of Agent Orange? The veterans who serve. The veterans feel responsible. Our fathers felt responsible for us. Even for in Vietnam, they felt responsible. The soldier, not the chemical companies or the government that made the decision.
So my father felt extreme guilt. He felt like he had caused my birth defects. He had told my mother that every time he looked at me, he felt that it was his responsibility. He had caused this to me. And that's a major problem in the United States, trying to work through the Agent Orange issue, is that the veterans feel extreme guilt.
The man that my mom knew from the time she was 4 did not come home from Vietnam. He's still wandering around in the jungle somewhere. He came home a very angry man, very sad man.
My dad was suffering more and more from his PTSD. He was having other health issues and he was getting weak and he couldn't do the things that he could do before, and his health was just going downhill.
Thank you.
the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address